In our study tonight, we're going to continue to talk about this blind man who has been healed. Well, in our study last time, we introduced this chapter. We've introduced this chapter a number of times, going back to chapter 7 coming forward. I'll not do that again tonight, but talk about the miracle of the man that was born blind and who now sees. This has always been kind of an exciting chapter to me because of the argumentation that takes place and the seeming spiritual blindness that is upon the leaders of the Jews. And here's a man who has been physically blind who now sees, and the marvelous things that he is now able to see. Interestingly enough, some of the things that he could see while physically blind indicate a tremendous perception on his behalf, his ability to hear the scriptures read and ascertain what they are teaching is quite remarkable. Well, in our study tonight, we've noted in the first few verses, perhaps I just need to stop sharing because I'm not at that point yet. But in the first few verses of this chapter, the question is raised about who sinned, this man or his parents, verse 2, that he should be born blind. And Jesus points out that neither this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him, in verse 3. Jesus knows what he's going to do, and this particular miracle that we're studying about is of uniqueness because it's included in the Gospel of John. John only records, as memory serves me, about 7 miracles. But as we look at the 20th chapter in verses 30 and 31, John records many other miracles, therefore did Jesus in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. Now, the very fact that John records the statement, many other signs, therefore did Jesus, that are not recorded in this book, indicates that he selected these particular ones to serve a specific purpose. These were more compelling. I wonder sometimes in my own small thinking, what was so unique about the ones that John selected, because after all, isn't a miracle a miracle? But there was something about these particular miracles that John selected that recorded, caused him to record them in this account. Jesus points out, contrary to the thinking of so many, that it was not because of sin that this man was born blind, either his sin or the sins of others. Now, I know, and we've talked about this before as we introduced this chapter, that yes, there are circumstances, there are consequences that follow as a result of some of the sins that we commit. You might die of cirrhosis of the liver because you drank yourself to death. You might be involved in an automobile accident that may kill you or kill somebody else because you were drinking. I'm not just picking on those who drink, but all kinds of consequences often follow sins directly that are committed. But that's not always the case. We may have the innocent victim who suffers as the result of the sin of somebody else. For example, somebody that's killed in an automobile accident who was hit by the drunk driver. Or it may be somebody that was just either knowingly or unknowingly was acting foolishly and tried to conflict the laws of nature. You jump off a roof, you're going to get hurt. You fall off the roof, you're going to get hurt. So there are all kinds of things that can result in various afflictions. But Jesus points out that whatever, and that's a whole study in and of itself, we'll not go there. But what I want to note here is that the point is, Jesus said that not this man nor his parents were guilty of sin that should cause him to be born blind, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Now, you can explore the providence of God in using this man that was born blind in order to accomplish this miracle on this occasion before this audience, and for this man and his reasoning to be set forth on this occasion. There's a lot that can be said relative to that we're not going to take the time to explore tonight. But what we want to note is in verse 4, as he continues, we must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night cometh when no man can work. When I am in the world, I am the light of the world. We noted that from John chapter 8, verse 12, in the beginning of that paragraph, that's why Jesus came into the world, to provide light. He's affirming that again regarding his identity. I believe it was in our last study, we noted verses 6 and 7, where when he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and anointed his eyes with the clay and said unto him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. And he went away, therefore, and washed and came seeing. Now, that's the stage that is set for really the rest of this chapter. Jesus has healed this man. And then the rest of the chapter revolves around the question, how was it that this man's eyes were opened? And it's quite a remarkable reasoning process on behalf of this man and lack of reasoning on behalf of those who are around this man. Now, in this text, I'm going to try to get my charts back up here. We note that in verse 10, the question is asked, how then were thine eyes opened? That's the first time that they've asked this question, which they continue to ask four times in this short chapter. How then were your eyes opened? The purpose of this miracle is being and has been served. We note that the purpose of the miracles were to confirm who Jesus is. And that's what John ultimately states in John chapter 20. Nicodemus had stated in John chapter 3 that no man can do the things that thou doest except God be with him. And the miracle of turning water into wine in John chapter 2 was for the purpose of declaring who he is. And we've already noted in Acts chapter 2, beginning in verse 22, when the apostle Peter calls the attention of those Jews to who Jesus is, he noted he performed signs among you. And you know that to be so. You know that's true. So the miracles that Jesus performed had an objective to confirm that he is who he claimed to be. Now, the neighbors begin to ask when this man points out that this man came to me and he said that go and wash and you'll come see. They want to know in verse 12, where is he? Well, this man hadn't kept up with who Jesus is or where he went. He said, I don't know where he is. All I know is he said to me, go to Siloam and wash. I went away and washed and received my sight. Now, we made analogies, I believe, last time to this text when we talked about Naaman, who was told to go and wash, and you will come again. Your flesh will be like the flesh of a little child. And Naaman went and washed, and he came, and his flesh was like the flesh of a little child. And we noted the importance of that little word and when we look at these illustrations, we tie that with repent and be baptized, or he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. And that little word and is a conjunction that ties together things of equal import. And in our previous studies, I used the illustration of a coupling pin that ties train cars together. It's just that important. It hooks them together so that they don't come apart. And we've got to see that here. This man could have gone to the pool of Siloam and not washed, and he would have been just as blind as he started out. He would not have been healed. And all because of the importance of that little word, and. Go to Siloam and wash. So I went away and washed, and I received my sight. Now, isn't that simple? When we're talking with somebody who's wanting to know what to do to be a Christian, how important it is that we talk about that little word, and. And here's a good place to illustrate that. Ask the people that you're studying with, would this man have received his sight if he had just gone to the pool of Siloam and not washed? Perhaps he would have received his sight if he had gone to some other pool and washed. No, we see that that's tied together with that little word "and" and makes each part of equal importance. He had to go to the right pool and he had to wash because that was the instruction that Jesus gave unto him. Now, beginning in verse 13 through the rest of this chapter, we find that the Jews condemn Jesus because he's healed this man born blind. Let's begin reading, if you will, at verse 13 of John chapter 9. And feel free just to jump in if you have a question or a comment, because I can only see four people. And if you have a question or comment, sometimes you may raise your hand for a long time and I won't see you. So just interrupt and jump right in there if you have something you'd like to say. Now in verse 13, he says, they bring to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind. Now it was the Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Again, therefore, the Pharisees also asked him how he received his sight. Now that raises some interesting questions. Why did they bring him to the Pharisees? Well, this is not anything new. In the seventh chapter, where this all started, in this setting of Jesus going into the city for the observance of the Feast of Tabernacles, in verse 47 of that text, we know that the officers from the Sanhedrin court have returned to the chief priest and the Pharisees, and they have not brought Jesus. Their purpose in being sent to Jesus was to arrest him, but they didn't bring him. And in verse 47, it says, the Pharisees therefore answered them, are ye also led astray? Hath any of the rulers believed on him or of the Pharisees? Now, I think there's something said in that when these officers report to the chief priest and the Pharisees that never man spake like this man, and so we didn't arrest him. Well, what about the rulers? Any of them believe? Any of the Pharisees believe? What does that indicate to you, that their consideration of the rulers or the Pharisees really was? What are they trying to say to this man born blind who now sees? They bring him to the rulers. Why? Don't you see that as an effort to make him feel small? Here's a beggar. Suppose that was you, and you've been begging all of your life, and your abilities had obviously been minimized because of your lack of sight. Your place in life, your social status had been kind of on the bottom rung because you're a beggar, because you can't do what other folks can do. And now you're being brought before the people that are recognized as being on a pedestal among the Jews. You're being brought before the Pharisees, before the rulers. Now, the two things in that I think that are important. One is that the Pharisees were considered as the authorities. They were the legal minds of the day, as it were. And here's this man who has been on the lower end of the totem pole, and he's brought before the rulers. Certainly that would be an intimidating experience. Suppose you, as Mr. Nobody, had been taken before the Supreme Court of the United States to make some kind of an argument. Do you think that that would be intimidating? So here we are, this man being brought before the leaders of the Jews, whose job it is to not only see him as a small person, but to make him aware of just how small he is. And yes, I heard somebody.
Yes, Randy.
Hi, Randy.
Yeah, in verse 18 there, it says the Jews did not believe it of him.
No, they didn't believe him, and they didn't believe him over and over.
Right, but I just mean in that particular instance, they're trying to trick Jesus into doing something they can arrest him for.
Oh, yes.
Here he's healed someone on the Sabbath, but they're not convinced that this guy was even blind because they're not convinced that Jesus did another miracle.
Well, that's true, but
they don't want to believe.
They don't want to believe that. And of course, the text of John 8 verses 1 through 11, when they brought the woman taken in adultery. This is in that setting. It's all for the purpose of trying to entrap Jesus. And here's a genuine, bona fide, first class miracle. And they're calling it in question. And they're trying to make the man who is affirming the truth appear small. And certainly they're trying to make it appear that Jesus has done something wrong, because their charge is he did it on the Sabbath day. And I find that appalling. But just at this point, in verses 13 through verse 15, he's brought before the Pharisees. That in itself would be somewhat intimidating. There's a purpose, obviously, behind it. Notice, if you will, as well, Randy, to your point, the fact that this was done on the Sabbath day. Here's a man that this man's neighbors know all of his life. The people who pass by the temple is likely where he was, as we see in Acts chapter 3, the man that was born lame, that's where he was. And that's where beggars often gathered. But to know that this miracle was done is one thing. But to acknowledge the miracle, you would think, would be in the forefront of their mind. But all they can see is that it was done on the Sabbath day. And to accuse Moses or accuse Jesus of violating the law of Moses. This is only one of seven instances where Christ healed on the Sabbath day. We have those on the board for you. But the making of the clay with the spittle. Now, we talked about the use of clay during New Testament times as a healing agent, and even the recognition of spittle as some kind of a healing agent during this era of time. But the fact that Jesus spit into the dirt and kneaded it into some kind of clay, they recognize that as an infringement on the keeping of the law pertaining to the Sabbath day. They regulated that. And of course, we know that the Sabbath laws were a part of the law of Moses, but how many laws had the Jews made affecting violation of the Sabbath? Certainly Moses had regulated that, but not like the Pharisees had. They had infinite details of what constituted a violation of the Sabbath day. And someone has suggested here that among 39 works, specific works that were forbidden to the Jews on the Sabbath day, kneading was one of them. And Jesus had kneaded the clay with his spittle to make the mud that he anointed this man's eyes with. So in the eyes of the leaders of the Jews, in particular the Pharisees, Jesus had violated the Sabbath day. And so this is how that they're reasoning about this. And the irony of that is they don't even seem to acknowledge that here's a man that's been blind all of his life and now he can see. Isn't that something? And they don't want to acknowledge that. Of course, the purpose is to disprove the miracle that Jesus had done. And Randy, this is to your point. Another question is, if Jesus was a sinner, how could he do the works that he did? Now, this blind man later affirms in verse 17, this man is a prophet. Now, hadn't Nicodemus already acknowledged that? How can Jesus do the things that he does unless God be with him? So the miracles that Jesus is doing are accomplishing the purpose, but they're accusing Jesus of being a sinner, for after all, he's violated what we say about the Sabbath law. He's violated the Sabbath day. So he can't be a prophet. He can't be of God. Even though he does have the power to make you see, he's got to be a sinner. Now, I want you to keep that in mind as we look at this man's reason. Daphne?
Yeah. You know, I always am impressed with the way God goes about doing things. And don't you know that Jesus availed himself of these opportunities so they could have this discussion? Now, he may not have had any hope that the Pharisees would, you know, come to an understanding, because they were plainly looking for a way to get rid of him for their own reasons. But the people, it says here, they're like, well, the Pharisees are telling them, these givers, these people who rule about the law, you know, well, he can't be this because of this and this. But you've got the people now looking at them and saying, you know, how can you be saying this when this is an obvious truth?
Yeah.
And they're beginning to look at them now and have suspicion, and it's raising question in their minds.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that Jesus did this just so they would have this discussion.
Well, you know, the irony of that, yes, Daphne, to your point, yes. What we see is the common folks understood him. We noted that a number of times. And we see in the seventh chapter at the beginning of this, essentially this scene when Jesus comes into the city of Jerusalem for this feast occasion, this debate ongoing about who he is. Even Jesus' own brothers don't believe who he is. And when he performs miracles, the question is raised in chapter 7, verse 26. Can it be that the rulers indeed know that this is the Christ? And then in verse 31, but of the multitude, many believed on him. And they said, when the Christ shall come, will he do more signs than those which this man hath done? Now, the thing that I find incredible, and you'll note in verse 40, a similar thought, this is of a truth, the prophet. The thing that's incredible to me is there are people that are getting it. There are folks that see it. And there are some, no matter how much evidence there is, they'll not get it. Times have really changed today, though, haven't they? Not really. Not really. And so here's our point. The common folks in Jesus' day, they were getting it. And what was causing them to get it? They were examining the evidence. What a novel thought to sit back and look at the evidence. How incredible. You see, these were afraid that the Jews would cast them out of the synagogue if they confessed that Jesus is the Christ. That's where the parents of this man are. Is this your son? How is it that he sees? Well, to the fact that he is our son, we will affirm, but he's of age. You ask him how it is that he sees. Real brave, aren't they? Even the man's own parents, knowing the evidence, they won't step out on a limb for Jesus and affirm what they know to be true. Let's read some more, beginning in verse 15. Again, therefore, the Pharisees asked him how he received his sight. And he said unto them, he put clay upon mine eyes, and I washed, and I see. And I want you to remember that statement, because it's so simple, and it seems so convincing and so compelling, and the evidence is so weighty. In verse 16, some, therefore, of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man that is a sinner do such signs? And don't that seem reasonable to them? In verse 17, they say, or verse 16, that last sentence I missed, and there was a division among them. Well, that division has existed all the way back to the beginning of this, in the seventh chapter. Who is this man? Jesus has told them time and time again, I came from God. God is my Father. Who is this man? Well, we can't be sure. So they're divided. In verse 17, they say therefore unto the blind man again, what sayest thou of him in that he opened thine eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. The Jews, therefore, did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of him and had received that had received his sight and asked them, saying, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then doth he now see? His parents answered and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now seeth, we know not. Or who opened his eyes? We know not. Ask him. He is of age. He shall speak for himself. Now, in verse 22, we see why they answered so. These things said his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man should confess him to be the Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, said his parents, he is of age, ask him. Now, there's just a lot of really interesting stuff in that. We can testify to you that we're his parents. We can testify to you that he was born blind. But we can't testify as to how he sees. He's of age, ask him. The thing that I find real interesting about that, we don't know how old this fellow was. We know other instances where people were healed. The age is a factor, it's given. But this man is old enough to be seated at, likely, as we mentioned, the gate of the temple where beggars often were seated to ask for alms, like we see in Acts chapter 3. So he's old enough, and he's old enough to be responsible to tell these folks how he was able to see. Some have suggested that the age of 13 was kind of a benchmarked age. Others suggest that the age of 21 was kind of a benchmark age. But the point is, his parents, they're cowards. How do we know that? Because they feared the Jews, the text tells us. It had already been stated that if anybody acknowledges him to be the Christ, he'd be cast out of the synagogue. They understood the rules. They know the politics. Bruce?
It just reminds you of we just went over Acts chapter 8, where they're questioning Jesus, but still, as they're questioning him, about the law, they do see that Jesus heals, but even though they heal, we see that they're steadily after Jesus.
It's a constant.
Not only catch him in a lie, but, hey, we're going to get him this time.
Yeah, this time. We're going to really get him this time. Yeah.
As you see, all of them, all of them walked away, beginning, with the older.
That didn't work, but we'll get him next time. Yeah. Daphne?
Yeah. In one of the Bible classes where I go to church, we're studying about the intertestamental period. And so one of the things they're talking about is how the synagogues were set up and where they came from and where that kind of thing came from. And I didn't understand when it says they could put them out of the synagogue. I didn't really get the full impact of what that means. They're talking that these people who are the heads of the synagogue had the power to excommunicate them.
Yep.
And so that doesn't mean, well, you just can't go to synagogue. It means that from every aspect of Jewish life, you're banished. You're unclean. No selling, buying, anything like that.
You're out of the loop.
His parents did kind of throw him under the bus on that deal.
They sure did.
Yeah. But I understand why they were so terrified by this question and by being in that position. Because that is not a small thing.
No, it was not.
No.
And thanks for the introduction to the next slide. You did good.
Sorry.
No. You're good. It's a springboard. You primed the pump just right for this next slide.
That's my job.
Yeah. No, that's okay. No, you're right. This was a big to-do to be cast out of the synagogue. It was very intimidating. And we note in John chapter 12 that many of the rulers of the synagogue believed on him, but they wouldn't confess it. Because they were afraid of being cast out of the synagogue, for they loved the glory of men more than the glory of God. I don't know that we fully wrap our minds around what kind of intimidation this was. This wasn't just a religious thing they're doing to them. This would sever social ties. This was their life. So we're talking about their livelihood, their social life, as well as their religious life. You're right. To be excommunicated among the Jews, that was a big time serious matter. And according to the Mishnah, they had two different forms of that. There could be a temporary exclusion that give you a little taste of what this is going to be like. It lasts for 30 days. And if the charge was serious enough, it would be a permanent ban. And the Jewish law included also a minor ban, about a week's duration, and then a permanent ban from any social life or participation in the synagogue. So this was a real big thing, and Jesus makes it a real big thing when he says that if you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father. But if you deny me before men, I will deny you before my Father. Now, as we look at this excommunication, and try to parallel that with the idea of fellowship or sharing or partnership, as it were, you see then the impact of what Jesus is saying here. What might be done to you by being excommunicated by men would be only temporary. Even if it's the rest of your life, it's temporary. But if I deny you before the Father, that's kind of forever. Now you stop and think about that. Now that's where this man is. You see, believers who are saved should have the courage of their convictions. We want to put this man's parents on the side. They don't have the courage of their conviction. But this young man that's born blind who now sees, I want us to see just how much he sees. We're not talking about just physical sight here. He has an understanding of who Jesus is. And to deny him, even in the face of being cast out of the synagogue, he won't do it. And notice his boldness. Now, the question I've highlighted in red, are you intimidated by what other people think? His parents were. This man was not. The rulers were in John chapter 12. This man that we might think of because of who he is and the nature of his affliction and what he's been able to do about it, to be a beggar, he's down at the bottom rung of the ladder of the social status, and now he's a man who's got a great deal of courage. He's not being intimidated by these Pharisees at all. Now, I want you to notice as well what we read or are going to read in verse 24. It says, so they called a second time the man that was blind and said unto him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. Now, don't be misled by they called a second time the man that was blind, because this is not the second time they've made inquiry. In fact, it's the third time that they've made inquiry about how he sees. But they called him in, which would indicate a formal hearing. We want you to tell us about this. But they started, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. Now, they set him up, don't they? Give glory to God. Tell us how bad this guy is, because we already know. You see, their reasoning is like we have on the board. The law forbid working on the Sabbath day. But Jesus healed on the Sabbath day. And their law was, now keep that in mind, the law that they had made, they had become so specific that kneading the spittle into the clay, that constituted work. So Jesus had violated the Sabbath. So because Jesus healed on the Sabbath, Jesus was a sinner. Just had to be so. Now, any of you have gone through classes on logic, that seems logical, doesn't it? The law forbids working. Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. Therefore, the conclusion, Jesus had to be a sinner. He'd violated the Sabbath. Now, what do we learn about logic and premises? Daphne?
Yeah, they presented him with a false premise. We know that Jesus is a sinner, therefore, blah, 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 blah. And that's not the right premise. And this guy goes, well, I don't know about that. I don't know if he is or not, but I know this. So sometimes you have to look at the thing that they're telling you and decide, is that actually even a truth? Sort of like asking a guy, did you stop beating your wife yet?
Yeah. Well, notice the law did forbid working on the Sabbath.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That their first premise is true. Their second premise, Jesus healed on the Sabbath, is really a false premise because it presumes that healing is the same as working on the Sabbath. Well, and so it's a false premise. So their conclusion will not follow.
But the other thing is that there was even debate between the Pharisees and the Sadducees as to what constituted work or things that you could do on the Sabbath. The Pharisees could go, what, couple of something or other, they could walk that far, but the Sadducees didn't think they could go out the door. So there was some sort of, you know, gray area in this Sabbath thing anyway, and they're not presenting it as if there are, as if there is.
Well, they filled in the blanks is the problem.
Yeah, so that's a little disingenuous right there.
It is. All right, Bruce?
But also, you've got to remember that in the beginning of chapter 9, the question was with Jesus' disciples, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents? You know, so we got to remember also the disciples had that understanding as well.
Well, the disciples, they're reasoning on a false premise too. You're right. And it's not a new one. We saw that was the problem that existed during the lifetime of Job. Job's friends, they were sure that he had done something terrible because of all the calamity that had come upon him. And so that kind of thinking is not anything new. But yes, you're right, Bruce. Even that way of thinking had characterized the disciples. But now this debate is ongoing with this blind man who now sees, and the leaders of the Jews, the Pharisees in particular. Now, we saw how they're reasoning. The law forbid work on the Sabbath. Jesus had healed, translated worked, on the Sabbath, therefore Jesus was a sinner. Well, this second premise won't stand because his healing on the Sabbath day, he was Lord of the Sabbath, and so consequently he had not violated the Sabbath. But look at how this man has reasoned. This man said, all I know. Now some of you will hear me make that statement, some of you more recently in Bible classes that we've had online. Regarding, you know, a lot of what ifs propositions that come into our study. All I know. Now that's what this man is saying. All I know is here's what the facts are. And that's all we can reason on the premise of what the facts are. We can't speculate. All I know was I was blind and now I see. Now their question as they continue to press, how is it that you can see? And this young man tells them, if I tell you again, will you accept my testimony? Look at verse 24 again. I'm sorry, verse 25. He therefore answered, whether he is a sinner, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see. Isn't that simple? And they said therefore unto him, what did he to thee? How opened he thine eyes? Now, you ever been asked to explain a miracle? As we would call that in Kentucky, can you explain a miracle? No. No, you can't explain. We hear a lot of folks that claim to be educated. My mother used to call them educated fools, trying to explain a miracle. This man is all I know. I can't explain to you the how. All I know is I was blind and now I can see. Well, how did he open your eyes? In verse 27, he answered them, I told you even now and ye did not hear. Wherefore would ye hear it again? Would ye also become his disciples? Now that's a legitimate question, isn't it? I've told you, how many times has he told them? Four times this question's been asked. Now, wouldn't you like to think that if you asked the same question and you got the same answer four times, you think if you ask it again, the answer's going to change somehow? That's the height of folly, isn't it? Now, these rulers, they keep pressing. How is it that you can see? This young man says, I've told you. And if I tell you again, it's not going to make any difference. Now, we've got John 10 on the board. I want you to look at it. It seems that the rulers of the Jews just have difficulty in their understanding. We've noted that John records only a few of the miracles that Jesus performed. But he did identify that many other signs, therefore, did Jesus in the presence of the disciples. And you would think out of the many other signs, as well as these specific ones that John records, that the evidence would be so overwhelming, so compelling, it would be beyond anybody raising a question. But in John chapter 10, reading beginning at verse 22, and it was the feast of dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in Solomon's porch. The Jews, therefore, came round about him and said unto him, how long dost thou hold us in suspense? If thou art the Christ, tell us plainly. Now, how long Jesus been preaching? How long Jesus been performing miracles? Upward of 3 years. Now, if you're the Christ, how long do you hold us in suspense? Why don't you just come right out and tell us plainly? Well, you just shake your head and wonder what it would take for these folks to understand. You remember in John chapter 4, when Jesus was speaking with the Samaritan woman, she said, I know that Messiah cometh, he that is called Christ. When he is come, he will declare unto us all things. Jesus said unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. Now let me ask you, do you understand what he said? Any difficulty or complexity in the statement that Jesus made to this woman? You'll note in John chapter 5, Jesus has performed a miracle that became a point of controversy. He healed a man who'd been lame for 38 years. Everybody knew he'd been smitten. And Jesus healed this man. And Jesus claimed in John chapter 5, mm-hmm. verse 17, my Father worketh even until now, and I work. And the Jews understood his claim and sought the more to kill him. Let me ask you, the fact that they sought to kill him, is that evidence that they knew exactly what he had said? Was that plain enough for them to get it?
Nick?
Yes.
That passage you were just talking about in John 5.
Yes.
He healed a man. The man, the lame man, told him to pick up his pallet and walk.
Yeah.
He didn't make any spittle.
No, he didn't.
He didn't actually do anything. He just said the words.
Yes.
Take up your pallet and walk. And he took up his pallet and walked. So what they got mad at him for then was not so much that he healed him, but that he told him to take up his pallet and walk.
Yeah. Told that man to violate the Sabbath.
Told that man to violate the Sabbath. Yeah. By walking with his pallet.
Yeah. So they want to kill him for that.
They're just looking for any good reason.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Now in John 8, we've already looked at that. Jesus said, for except you believe that I am he, ye shall die in your sins. Any ambiguity in your mind about what Jesus said? Does that seem plain enough? And then in John chapter 8, we've already noted this. Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am. And they took up stones, therefore, to cast at him. Why do they want to kill him? Are they having difficulty understanding what he's saying? The miracles? The claims? Is there any difficulty in your mind when you look at what's said in the text that they don't have any difficulty understanding him? So then the statement, how long do you keep us in suspense? If you're the Christ, tell us plainly. Now that's what they're doing to this man born blind in John chapter 9. What more evidence does it take? In John chapter 10 verse 36, Jesus said, I am the Son of God. I don't get it. Somehow it makes me scratch my head, Randy, when it don't itch. Maybe you need to make it a little clearer for me. I don't understand what you're saying to me. No, the language is not difficult. In verse 25 of John 10, Jesus answered them, I told you and ye believed not. So the question is not a problem of understanding. The problem is their perception. They're not willing to let the evidence do its work. He later said, if ye had known me, John 14, you would have known my Father also. From henceforth you know him and have seen him. Philip saith unto him, Lord, show us the Father, and it sufficeth us. Now keep in mind, how many miracles has Philip been witness to? And Jesus said unto him, have I been so long time with you, and dost thou not know me, Philip? He said, he that has seen me has seen the Father. How sayest thou, show us the Father? Now, how did Philip respond to that? Did he believe who he was? You see, the problem is not in the evidence. The problem is in the preconceived notions. You'll note the reaction, and then we'll wind this up, that they reviled this man born blind. We're told by lexicographers that that simply means to speak in a highly insulting manner. Can't you just picture these self-righteous Pharisees looking down on this man that has been blind all of his life? He's not one of the major breadwinners of their society. And they're making fun of him, ridiculing him, insulting him, because he's affirming that Jesus is the one that healed him, and therefore he must be a prophet. Notice, thou art his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. Now just take that. We know that God has spoken unto Moses, but as for this man, we know not whence he is. Now wait just a minute. Why didn't they know whence he is? Hadn't Jesus told them? When questions arose about the words that he was saying, didn't he already affirm that the words that I speak came from my Father? I came from my Father? This implies a question that's already been asked and already been answered. We know not whence he is. Well, you do too. It's not because of a lack of evidence, and it's not because of a lack of testimony. In John 9, 30 and 31, the man answered and said unto them, why herein is the marvel that you know not whence he is? And yet he opened mine eyes. We know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and do his will, him he heareth. This man not quite so dumb as they think he is he? What's the problem? Why do you marvel? Because you don't know where he came from. He opened mine eyes. That's never been done before. Nobody ever did that before. All since the beginning of humanity, nobody's ever done that. And you're making a big to-do because you don't know whence he is. You don't know where he came from. Now, I'll conclude with this chart because I think just putting them side by side helps us to see how much this young man has learned and the validity of his reasoning. The Jews' reasoning is, this man is not from God. We know he is a sinner. Why? Well, the law forbids to work on the Sabbath. Jesus healed on the Sabbath. Here's where they're flawed. Therefore, Jesus must be a sinner. He's not from God. But this young man says, he is a prophet. He's reviled by the Jews. And how does he come to the conclusion that Jesus is a prophet? Well, because he knows that God heareth not sinners, but God heard this man. This man opened mine eyes. If he were not of God, he could do nothing. And you find a flaw in that. Find a flaw in his reasoning. Now you can find a flaw over here. Their logic doesn't follow. But this man's logic is flawless. Do you see that? And his conclusion is, since the world began, it was never heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. So who is this man? Well, he must be a prophet. He must be of God. I would to God that all of us could reason so clearly, so logically. Now, in our next study, we'll start with this chart. So make a note of that, Richard. I do want to start with this chart. And I've got a reason for wanting to start with this chart, because of the simplicity of the man's logic. But we're going to look at this first point of his premise. God heareth not sinners. How'd he know that? We're going to know in our next study, we look at some evidence, how this man knew this. He was born blind, but there's no evidence that he was born stupid. Okay? This man has evidence for the statements that he's making, and we'll look at that. Anybody have a question or a comment? Okay? No questions, no comments? Can't even lure one out of it. No, can't get one. All right, Breba's got one back in the back there.
But my analogy would be that it wasn't that they did not understand. they were just trying like a mind game, reverse psychology. If a person continues to ask you the same question and you don't have the confidence within yourself, they take mind control over you so that they get you to thinking differently. So in his defense, he stood up, he pleaded his case, but by continuing to ask him the question, they wanted him to fumble that he did see at one time. And yep. then there was no more miracle that took place.
But he didn't fumble.
He stood his ground.
No, he didn't fumble. Now that raises an interesting question. Why didn't he fumble? You know, if you'd been that beggar, you know, just a nobody, considered nobody by the society in which you live. Now here you're being judged by the hierarchy of the society in which you live. And they keep playing these games with you, asking you the same question over and over. And certainly that's to rattle your cage. Why wasn't his cage rattled?
Because he could see.
He could see. Yeah. The evidence was clear to him and he could see physically, but he could see things they couldn't see because his mind is clear. He's willing to examine the evidence. Isn't that a marvel? What a treat it is to be able to study the Bible with somebody who's a blank slate like this man was.
He was joyous.
He was joyous. Yes. Isn't it exciting? You've had that privilege, no doubt, to study the Bible with somebody that has a good heart, just as honest and sincere as the day is long. And when you read it, they've got it. They've just got it because their mind is prejudiced by some other falsehood or hierarchy that they think they have to submit to. Just a real pleasure. Well, I'll stop with that. And let's see. Let me pick on somebody. Stephen Harper, I see you there. Would you be prepared in just a moment to lead us in a closing word of prayer? But sure. Before we do, I want to extend the Lord's invitation. You know, these things are so simple. We started out with, he told me to go and wash, and I did. I went and washed, and I came seeing. Maybe I'm talking to somebody in the class this evening. You understand what it simply says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned. Repent and be baptized for the remission of your sins. Confess me and I will confess you. Boy, that little word and is powerful. You could make that the title of sermon sometime. And it occurs a lot of times. Very important word. If you see the need for that, this evening, we'll help you in whatever way we can to obey the gospel. Maybe you've done that and you're not living a righteous life. The words you need to see are found in 1 John chapter 1, beginning in verse 7. Confess, and of course you need to repent of your sin. Change the way that you live, and God has promised that the blood of his son is sufficient to forgive you. If we can help you with that, we'd be happy to in any way. Make that known to some of us.